premise of an AI that is capable of acting autonomously is one that I struggle with. AI models fundamentally do nothing except predict the next token. AI systems do things, and somebody has to turn them on and turn them off.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of the sharpest minds and quickest wits to help you digest the week's news in artificial intelligence. Today, I'm joined by a championship lineup crew. We have Mihai Crivetti, who's a distinguished engineer, agentic AI, Gabe Goodhart, chief architect, AI open innovation, and Sandy Besson, AI research engineer. Welcome to you all. We've got a very, very packed episode. I think I was just informed by one of our producers we're going to try to wedge another story in. We're going to talk about Tongyi Deep Research. We're going to talk about AP2. We're going to talk about AI's killing us. We're going to talk about the new AirPods. And finally, we're going to talk about a small $100 billion investment. But first, we've got Eily with the news. Eily, over to you.
Hey everyone, I'm Eily McConnon. I'm a tech news writer for IBM Think. I'm here with a few AI headlines you might have missed this week. Another news story involving Trillion with a T. Yes, that's Trillion. OpenAI has unveiled plans to build $1 trillion worth of data centers across the US and abroad. Can tech companies be frenemies? Chinese tech giant Alibaba is partnering with American chipmaker NVIDIA. Alibaba will use NVIDIA's hardware and software to develop robotics and self-driving cars. Turns out, there's a world of useful information in those PDFs that most people never read. Granite Dockling, a small but mighty new model from IBM, can decode those PDFs and has jumped to the top of the most downloaded models list on Hugging Face this week. Are you suffering from swipe fatigue from online dating apps? Well, Meta has added a new digital dating assistant to Facebook, so you can use AI to identify your special somebody more easily. Want to dive deeper into some of these topics? Subscribe to the Think newsletter. It's linked in the show notes. Now, back to the episode.
So for our first segment, I really wanted to talk about Tongyi Deep Research. So this is a model that has zoomed to the top of the Hugging Face leaderboards. It's an agentic large language model that, quote, features 30 billion total parameters with only 3 billion activated per token. And it's a model that's specifically designed for long horizon, deep information seeking tasks. And best of all, it's all open source. So Gabe, given you're our open source guy, maybe I'll kick it over to you first. Initial impressions about this model, what do you think?
I think it's a really cool step forward. And I think the novelty in this model is that it was task trained specifically for this long horizon and paired with software that was designed to implement the long horizon search in an iterative, recursive way. And I think that's really cool. So, you know, at this point, generating tokens is not novel. Your mixture of experts is not novel. But the shape of those tokens that are generated and the patterns that it was trained on are novel. And that's pretty cool. I specifically think their heavy mode is a really interesting doubling down on a specific agentic architecture around state management and consolidation that we haven't seen. We've certainly seen individual agents built to do this pattern, but we haven't seen them paired with a purpose-built model. And I think, you know, there are a lot of great public implementations of some flavor of deepness in research out there that can run on your laptop. I use them regularly, but I will say, you know, they don't measure up to public frontier model implementations. And I think it's really cool that this team is pushing the boundary there and trying to get something that you can run on a powerful workstation to measure up to a frontier research system. So kudos to, you know, really pairing the model implementation and the software ecosystem around it. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I think it's a really big kind of development. And Mihai, maybe I can call on you to talk a little bit about trends. I think one of the things we're always watching at MOE is like sort of this frontier, right, between sort of like the proprietary model and open source catching up. And it feels like over the last few months, that just continues to narrow and narrow and narrow and narrow. And so, like, I guess maybe this is always a good data point to check in. Like, do you feel pretty soon like this margin is going to disappear, right? Like it really will be that every time a proprietary model comes out, we're going to see an open source implementation that's almost as good, like almost immediately.
I think it's likely, although if you look at the use cases, that's where we see the biggest differentiation between these models. A lot of the use cases we have for these smaller models, especially the open source models that can compete in this space, have to do with embedded devices, with local laptops, with privacy, being able to run these models, you know, behind a firewall or running them at a cost. If you look at the use case of deep research, since we're talking about agents and deep research, that's basically a large language model that's doing planning to use tools like both intranet search and internet search, as well as searching all of your document collections and really going through potentially millions of tokens that can get expensive and that can get very slow if you're using one of the frontier models. So there's a lot of organizations who are looking for doing this cheaper, faster, with smaller models, preferably behind their firewall, especially if you have some of these models work with financial data or HR data or internal data. So I definitely see a sweet spot for many of these smaller, I would say, purpose-built models.
Yeah, for sure. I think almost you're saying, like, we think about it as like, oh, is open source catching up? I guess, Mihai, do I hear you right in kind of saying almost like we should think about these as like almost two different markets? Like what open source is trying to do, actually pretty different from like what, like, I don't know, OpenAI is trying to do?
I believe so. And look, OpenAI also has their, you know, GPT-5 Nano, which is, you know, too cheap to meter, 35 cents for a million token, or I'm probably leaving a comma left or right in the price. But again, too cheap to meter. I don't care if I'm using it for agents. I know it's fast. I'm going to know it's going to be cheap enough and I can throw it at use cases like deep research and say, yeah, it's fine to crawl through 100 of these websites and send every one of those tokens. But maybe the CIO office is not going to agree with me sending all of that intranet data to one of these large language models. So if there's a model that can run it privately or a model I can run on my laptop or maybe even in the future on my phone, that's awesome.
Sandy, I want to bring you into this conversation. One of the things that we talked about on the last episode was that there's this paper that came out that was called something like, what are people using ChatGPT for? And I thought the funny part about it was like everybody looked at it and I think our guests were all like, it's search. People are using ChatGPT for search. And I guess to Mihai's comment, it almost kind of feels like what we might see if we had a paper that was like, what are people using open source models for? Is like it would look very, very different. And I guess the kind of question for you is like, do you feel like these ecosystems are going to just keep diverging over time? Like that over time, we should actually really think about like open source almost solving like a completely different set of problems from what, you know, the like a ChatGPT is trying to solve.
I think it's the juxtaposition of productizing versus plugging into a broader, more like bigger problem, right? Typically in open source solutions, they're not solving like the whole suite. They're solving like a very narrow piece of the puzzle. So I could very much see using this deep research agent as part of a broader agent team or broader agent architecture. But it's probably not going to be like the full picture that stands alone and is like a hosted solution somewhere, right? And so I kind of see it diverging in that way. Now, like, I also wonder, slightly tangentially, but like, I wonder, we saw, was it this year or last year with DeepSeek? I can't even remember timelines anymore. But we see, once in a while, these big papers come out, and I don't know whether this one will be that kind of big paper for this type of trend or pattern, but I think just like we saw DeepSeek kind of emphasize distillation, and now distillation became a big deal after the DeepSeek paper came out, I wonder whether this paper would trigger some sort of trend in terms of that triathlon of training, where you do like continual pre-training, then fine-tuning, and then on policy RL. Like, I wonder whether this will now become a common pattern because of this paper.
Yeah, that's right. And that's actually a fun way of thinking about it. We haven't really talked about it like that on the show before. I think frequently we're very like benchmark brained, right? We're like, oh man, this model is like so much better on this benchmark and not as good on this benchmark. Sandy, you're almost saying like we should almost measure how important a model is by almost like how influential it is, right? In terms of like how it kind of shapes how people are doing things.
Totally. Sometimes it's not the first model that comes out that's actually like, quote unquote, the best. It might be Soda in some ways, but like it's actually the trend that it drives that like points us in a different direction.
Gabe, maybe a final question on this before we move to our next topic. I wonder a little bit about business model here. So if you're Tongyi Labs, right, you've just done this open source thing. At some point, do you also want to go closed source? Like, I think we've been talking a lot about the big kind of like OpenAI and Anthropic, you know, kind of all sort of leaning and thinking more about open source. But I wonder if the ecosystem goes the other way at some point, where like leaders in open source eventually start to go more closed as well, or if, you know, almost like constitutionally, it's like a different direction.
So I actually really like something that you said, Sandy, and I'm going to pick on it here, which is like, it's really this two directional, like the closed source products are trying to give something to you. Like, here's a thing, you should have it. The open source tools, software, and models are trying to plug into an existing ecosystem. So do I think that labs that are primarily open source are eventually going to want to go closed source too? I think that's a possibility. I think if they come up with something genuinely novel or something that they really think, you know, we could actually put this in front of people and people would be willing to pay us for it, and they can't get it anywhere else, we have a shot at taking the crown on some novel capability, they might. I think the other route, and especially that I've seen when talking with other small organizations that have an open core, the other route is really leaning into that plug-in portion. And that, by that, I mean an enterprise tier of some variety, right? And so engaging with your same open source componentry, possibly with some additional componentry around it for meeting enterprise needs like better authentication management, better data sovereignty, et cetera, and engaging in almost like a consulting type of view with a large enterprise client that allows them to have a revenue stream for their software while continuing to push the envelope in the open. So I think that's the business model that I have seen more often for these types of shops. And the other thing you said, Sandy, that I also loved was like, there's also just the influence game, like especially depending on the life cycle of these startups, a lot of times the metric isn't dollars, it's likes, clicks, retweets,
downloads,
and download stars, all of the social metrics, right? And I think I don't frankly know quite where we're at here, but I think depending on the journey of whether or not they're being measured on dollars, it may still just be in the can we move the needle on the influence game. And I think that in and of itself is a business model that has a decent chance of panning out either in an acquisition or in enterprise deals. I think the leap to being a private self-propelling entity that has products you offer to the market is a tough one to make.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I want to create like the most like punk rock lab, which is like a disaster from a business standpoint, but is just like incredibly influential.
Exactly. So, exactly.
Most stars of any lab, you know.
You're not alone there. There are labs that are literally doing that.
That's right. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. I always joke that you know a space is really maturing when people are introducing protocols to sit on top of other protocols. And we have a good example of that from this week. Google announced a new protocol that they are calling AP2. And AP2 builds upon a lot of existing agent frameworks, like Model Context Protocol and other things that we've talked a lot about. And what AP2 is attempting to do is basically set up a common structure for agents to engage in commerce and payments online. And sort of, you know, in the blog post, Google sort of describes what they're really trying to do is make sure that agents can, you know, have proper authorization, be authentic, right, and be sort of accountable to the fact that they're going to move money around for people in the future. And the most fun part about it is that AP2 explicitly contemplates a situation where you are not there when your agent goes out and does its stuff on the internet. And what they're proposing is a thing that they call the intent mandate, which is a cryptographically signed record of what you want the agent to do. And that's kind of how they instantiate, like, okay, what's the scope of authority you're giving the agent to do when it goes out there and, I don't know, you know, puts a bunch of books into a shopping cart and, you know, checks out for you. So, Mihai, I guess you're our agents guy, I think, on this panel. How big of a deal is AP2? Like, do you think it's going to get big adoption? Do you think people should be paying attention to it?
I think it's got huge potential because it kind of tries to solve a problem that neither A2A or MCP solve today. And the reality is, if you look at the ecosystem, MCP is solving the problem of building your tool once and having that tool work with any kind of agentic framework. So you're kind of decoupling the agent and the tool. But all of the respective security authentication authorization mechanisms that you're going to use, how you're handling secrets, secrets management, data management, certificate management, is really left up to you in terms of how you implement it or how you make it work. And there's already like five versions of MCP, and they all implement, you know, more and more and more around the area of security. But I don't think we're at the point where we can say, yep, this is something I can easily build a payments processing system on top of, or, you know, have an agent go off and book my travel to some island and, you know, make all the payments and trust it with that information. Not even from the perspective of trusting it to get it right, but from a perspective of how it's handling that data. You can't put your payment information, your credit card information, in the text that goes into the model. There needs to be some kind of a side mechanism on how that data is transferred, cryptographically verified, not up to the interpretation of a large language model. So I think what Google did here was very smart. They tried to leapfrog the effect that MCP got, because MCP has been adopted virtually everywhere, Microsoft, OpenAI, IBM, and so on. A2A probably less so. So now they went to all of the banks, all of the financial institutions, and especially some of their core client base, both in the finance industry, but also in the advertisement industry. Because I can see this take up, for example, for, you know, those single-person shops who are using TikTok as their mechanism of advertisement and say, hey, talk to your personalized shopping assistant. It's going to pick the right clothes for you. You take a picture with your camera, and it's going to buy you a new, you know, kind of dress or pants or whatever every single month and ship it back to you. And you give it the authority to make those purchases on your behalf. So I think it could potentially open up a new market, a market they're very competent in, where they have potential both clients and relationships in, where I don't think Anthropic, for example, has the same kind of leverage within the same institutions. They're not a payment provider like Google has Google Pay. So I think it's a brilliant move. I do think some of the items are, so they're also releasing X4.2 extensions for A2A. So this is going back to crypto payments.
Yeah.
So we're going back to Web3 and MetaMask and the Ethereum Foundation and Coinbase. It's like, wait, I thought we were done with the Web3 stuff. Or we're now doing AI. Come on, one trend at a time. So I think it'll be interesting. It'll be even more interesting if we see somebody like Facebook and their metaverse get excited about it. But time will tell.
I'm so glad I spent those 2 weeks about a year and a half ago figuring out how to write smart contracts. That might be useful now.
Exactly. It was all worth the investment of time and effort. Well, so there's two directions to go in. I think I want to hit on both of them. I guess one of them, that just to build on what you just said, was thinking a little bit about, like, I hadn't really thought about basically, like, this is sort of competition between kind of Anthropic and Google in some sense. If you're Anthropic, like, what is the counter move here? Do you really care?
I mean, we'll have to see if Anthropic adopts it. That would be an interesting move, because, you know, we've seen that even OpenAI, for example, has adopted MCP now, and you can go in ChatGPT and use that. So we're going to see if we see similar adoption from Anthropic. Maybe the protocols are going to merge and we're going to have A2A plus MCP plus AP2 all in one big...
one protocol to rule them all. Yeah.
One protocol to rule them all for AI agents securely doing anything, but we'll
see.
Right.
Sandy, could I ask you a question about, so I used to do a lot of work in the privacy space. And I think, like, one of the things that we always thought for privacy is surely everybody will wake up one day and care about their privacy. And so we're going to create lots of things for people to kind of like tweak, like the data that they share. And then every time there's a large data breach, you'd say, surely now people will want to care about their privacy. And so I guess I have a question for you on just like, I see some of this stuff and maybe I'm just like very skeptical at this point. I'm kind of like, do agents need this kind of thing in order to succeed? Like, implicitly, we're always like, oh, well, you need trust in order to transact online. But, like, isn't one counter argument that, like, kind of people don't care? And so, you know, this will be maybe good at the margin, but it's not really, like, necessary for agents to start really interacting in the economy.
I think, you know, if you want to, it really shifts the liability, right? Like, it shifts the liability from the security aspect, which hopefully AP2 has covered, right, to the ability of the model itself to make the right choices, like Mihai said. And I think people don't care as long as it goes right, right? Like if AP2 is already in place, yeah, people won't really care. They won't even know it's in place. That's at the protocol level. Most people don't even know it's happening, right? You're using an agent interacting with an agent on a platform. You don't know whether it's an A2A agent or it's using MCP servers or what's going on behind the scenes, right?
In fact, it's good that you don't know.
And so I think in a way people won't care, but the people developing the tools and the institutions that are responsible for the liability will care. And so everyday consumer, no, I don't think they care. They like to be told that it's trustworthy and that their stuff is secure, but they don't care how. The people that are liable, I think they will. And I think they, like Mihai was saying, it's such a smart move for Google because this will force adoption of A2A as well. Because in order to use it, it's built on top of A2A. And so it will become the de facto that if you want to use this secure payment protocol, you're also making it an A2A compatible agent. And so I think that they will gain a lot of market share there. And there was some chatter to your comment about Anthropic developing a similar agent-to-agent type protocol. But we haven't seen it yet. And so maybe they will develop it. But they started talking about that like a good 6 months ago. Maybe they're developing it internally and they haven't released it. Or maybe they've kind of taken the OpenAI approach where they were like, yeah, MCP, like OpenAI was like, yeah, we'll just adopt MCP. Maybe that will happen too.
Yeah, I think one other item here is the market is targeting as well. Because I'm probably not the demographic or the market who's going to set up a personalized shopper on TikTok based on some ad I've seen scrolling down and go, oh, sure, $100 every month. You can go off and do some random shopping for me, or I'm not going to delegate my vacation to some assistant. I'm going to be there. I'm going to check every single hotel. I'm going to do the numbers. I'm going to edit up. I'm going to go to the payment. I'm going to look, has the payment gone through? So I think consumer habits are changing as well. And there is certainly a market for it. It's emerging. It's not quite there yet. But maybe in 10 years, everybody's going to just go off and say, you know, hand it over to the AI to do my shopping. It'll figure out what I need.
For sure. And I think it's not too far away. You know, like some people set up recurring payments and the whole point of that is to offload, you know, a transaction each month. The question is just like, how much broader are you happy with that going, you know, over time?
I've never set up a single recurring payment on Amazon ever. Whenever I see one of those, I was like, I don't trust it.
Yeah. Okay.
Something that I do think will this will propel is the use of computer use. You know, until now, computer use has been kind of like research-based, right? Just collect information in a way that you can't access other ways. But once we have this protocol in place and it's able to actually check things out for you securely and manage secrets and credentials, and I think that that will propel the actual usability of computer use, where right now it's like a cool thing, but honestly, no one's using it that much in practice.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's kind of like the downstream effects. And maybe it turns out like once you get payments right, like lots of other things kind of come out of it. I'm going to move on to our next topic. We're going to do a little bit of a book review for our next segment. So a book came out that has been getting a lot of chatter online. It's dramatically titled, If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies. And it's a book authored by two longstanding, you know, people who I think have participated in the AI policy, AI safety discussion, Eliezer Yudkowsky and Nate Soares. I guess, Gabe, maybe I'll kick it over to you first on this. The core of the book is the idea that at some point we may build super intelligent AI, and in which case, the minute we build it, it becomes really dangerous and everybody might die. Hence the title, If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies. We can talk about the validity of that claim, but I think I actually want to start somewhere different, which is I think part of the argument of the book, which I found quite interesting, is just to kind of take the CEOs of all these AI companies at face value, where we have had kind of a cycle of CEOs coming out and saying AI is probably the most powerful, most dangerous, most risky, most promising technology. And, you know, I think almost that argument of the book is basically like, if you buy what they're saying, shouldn't they be a lot more careful than they are right now? And I'm curious about what you think about that as an argument.
Shouldn't they be a lot more careful than they are right now? It's a very good question. You know, certainly some introspection here, as we are also hopefully helping to build some technology in this domain. I think there are a couple of aspects to this that the premise of an AI that is capable of acting autonomously is one that I struggle with, because somebody has to write a for loop. Now, that somebody might be another AI model, but somebody had to write the for loop for that AI model, etc. AI models fundamentally do nothing except predict the next token. AI systems do things, and somebody has to turn them on and turn them off. And so, yes, absolutely, at a meta level, care needs to be taken to ensure that the systems we are building do not have the aggregate set of capabilities to hit any of these escape points that we have considered. I think from a hypothetical what could go wrong perspective, there are real risks here, right? Fundamentally, the issue here is a much more holistic one than some simplistic evolution of a sentient AI. It is a system of humans, companies, software, hardware, and yes, a whole pile of floating point numbers coming together. And the humans are the input to that system, right? And I think one of the big worries is obviously that the models themselves, the system itself, becomes self-propagating. And that only happens if you give it the tools and the capabilities to become self-propagating. And so this fear about that, if somebody did it, it's possible, it could happen. But the safety procedures, the use cases that these systems are being set up for, can and should be limited to avoid these scenarios. And I think at least what we're seeing currently, you know, I highly, highly doubt that OpenAI is letting GPT-5 write code that goes into GPT-5.1, at least not carte blanche without any engineers looking at it. So it's really the humans in the loop that we have to be careful of. And as stewards of this technology, we have to make sure that we're being diligent about that. But I don't think we're anywhere close to escape velocity on doomsday.
Gabe, I saw you wrapping up, and then Mihai and Sandy immediately went off mute. Sandy, how about you go first?
Well, I wish that I had a more of a question to pose to Canva's opinions. Do you think we're going to get close enough where we go, oopsie, and then like backtrack and be like, okay, maybe that was like a little far. That was a little scary. We learned a lesson from that.
Maybe one example, and then Gabe would be interested in your response. You know, in the autonomous vehicles context, it's true that, like, you know, there was a company called Cruise, right, that was in San Francisco operating. They had a number of accidents and had to pull back. And then, you know, but, you know, I guess luckily there was like the technology retooled, and now Waymo and a number of other companies are kind of running in the space. And so I guess, Sandy, we have like, at least maybe by way of responding to your question, it's like almost like we do see that pullback and iteration. I guess the question is whether or not, like, you know, AI broadly writ, I guess, is maybe different in that respect. Gabe, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're still holding the steering wheel. So absolutely, we will definitely see cases where we have real world harm done and have to dial it back. In fact, we're seeing that now. You know, there are whole huge discussions to be had around the negative role. We've had it on this podcast to some degree of these models in the context of educating children, or mental health in terms of folks going down rabbit holes that they wouldn't with another human, and have, you know, an infinite self-reassuring hallucination machine in front of them. So there are real, real risks to these things, and I do not mean to minimize those. But it's particulate. Here's an area where these things have risk. Now let's go address it by trying to tackle this risk. The sort of runaway acceleration, end of the world scenario still feels, I don't really see us sort of knocking on that door short of some like genuinely bad actors entering and trying to break things and trying their best to, be a villain in a deep underground lair and launch the apocalypse. So
in other news, I've heard that Cloud Code is writing 95% of the code for Cloud Code.
Yeah.
So AI is writing
all right,
AI.
All right, fine. Okay, you're right.
I think it is writing itself at this point.
Yeah. On a more serious note, I think this has been a trend in every single piece of literature, media, movies, and games. So I personally really enjoyed, for example, some of the games like Mass Effect, where you have the Reapers, which is like a sentient species of AI, where humanity built AI. At some point, they realized it was sentient, and then they went, whoops, we're going to stop that. And when the AI saw that it was being stopped, it reacted and said, oops, and humans are our enemies. There's also Dune. Like, if you remember, in Dune, one of the premises was thou shall not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind, because that's how the whole thing started. There was the Butlerian jihad, and then when, AI and humans fought, and since then you were not allowed to build AI. There's Shodan in System Shock. If you played DOS game 1995, 96, whenever that came out, where again somebody built a super intelligent AI and it turned on mankind, or Matrix. So I think in every popular media, games, movies, books, this has been a trend. Whether it's going to happen, we don't really know. Should we be more careful? Well, if we're careful, then our competition is not going to be careful, and they're going to get ahead of us. So everybody's pushing to create more and more innovation. I think at some point there need to be guardrails in terms of how these AI systems are allowed to connect and interact with the real world. Should you have an AI system, for example, in charge of medical equipment or make life and death decisions? So for example, if you have an accident and you're in the hospital, the AI can go in and say, we're going to turn off your life support because we can use your organs. And that decision is made by an AI, no longer by your family and the doctor. So it can take some very dark turns if we don't create rules and regulations in terms of what systems we're allowed to connect these AI applications to. But as long as you're connecting it to your GitHub repo tools or your web search tools, I think we're going to be fine.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't feel like deep research presents this threat.
Mihai made a good point. He referenced a lot of fictional fears of humans. And I think this is what this plays into, whether it's true or not. It is clearly a fear of humanity, is that we will be overcome or become extinct or taken over. And then if you think about, okay, well, what is artificial intelligence trained on? Okay, all of the data comes from humans, at least right now, right? Like all of the data comes from the internet and our own, fears and our own publications. And so clearly, like maybe in some ways where it's chicken and egg, we're kind of like enabling this aspect of it not wanting to be shut down because it's fed on all of our fears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. Because I was about to say, well, Mihai, you're just talking about fiction. This book is supposed to be a piece of nonfiction. I guess, Sandy, you've already kind of anticipated me because you're kind of saying, well, there's sort of a weird part to this, which is regardless of what AI is, it's informed by all this data that has this fiction. And so it itself is kind of reenacting this in real life. And so there's kind of this weird kind of muddling between the fiction of what these AIs do and the reality of what they will do under a number of conditions. Cool. Well, we've got, as I promised, a lot to cover, so I'm going to move us on to our next story of the day. This was a fun one, and also building again from the discussion that we had last episode. So last episode, we talked a little bit about a startup called Alter Ego and Meta doing a bunch of demos with wearables, right? They launched a new Ray-Ban that has a bunch of AI features built into it, and they had some problems on the demo, but the features are pretty cool. And I guess not to be left out, Apple is dropping its new AirPods, which I'm wearing one of them here today. The cool thing about the sort of new AirPods, though, is that they're going to have this built-in feature for real-time translation. Which I think is like in some ways been like one of the really cool dreams of AI that I've been waiting for many years, is the idea that like you can hear audio and then it just translates into a language you know autonomously. And so I guess, Gabe, maybe I'll kick it over to you. You know, this is pretty cool, and it feels very different from a lot of the other wearable AI features that have been launched lately. But I'm having a hard time articulating why this feels so different. And so I'm wondering if you could help me kind of like think a little bit about like, why is this maybe different, or maybe it's actually quite same to like what Meta is attempting to kind of portray as like the future of how AI is going to be with you.
I think this is a solution to a problem instead of a solution in search of a problem. And I think that's why this feels different. You know, we work for an international company. I think most discourse that I engage in happens in English, but there are many folks for whom that's not their first language. And as a native English speaker, I feel both privileged and a little bit bad all the time about forcing everyone to conform to my language, right? I think language translation, whether it's for personal travel, whether it's for international commerce, whether it's for just about anything, is a real, real issue in a global world, and people face it every day. And so, yes, lots of cool possible features out there that could use AI in real time on some kind of a device attached to my body that I might like try out the demo and think, man, this is super cool, and then put away. But I could see, certainly not for everyone, not everybody lives in a multilingual world, but for folks that do, a earpiece that you stick in that can give you that translation with minimal effort and a smooth UX is a real game changer. So it's an actual problem and an actual solution to the problem. I think that's why this feels different.
Sandy, is this the beginning of Apple making a comeback on the AI side of things? You know, I think the most interesting reversal of fortunes we've been observing for the last 12 months has been, oh my God, Apple's going to kill it on AI. Oh man, they seem so far behind. And also Google, they seem so behind too. Wow, they seem to be really doing all good all of a sudden. I guess the question is if we're about to like go through another inflection point where by December next year, we're going to be like, oh, Apple's got this. We should have never have doubted them.
You know, I've been getting a lot of ads for Google's new phones on my TV. I'm being targeted for that. So, and I was just talking to my husband yesterday. I was like, I wonder whether they're going to take over Apple's device sales very shortly, because they're so integrated in with the entire ecosystem, right? That's Google's MO, is to integrate everything together. Do we know the model actually being used for the translation in the AirPods? Has that been released?
The article mentioned Apple Intelligence, which is their like multi-layered on-device plus escalate to a secure cloud plus escalate to a frontier model at all costs. So I doubt we know specifically, but I suspect there's an on-device component for the latest iPhones.
Sure, like with the latency, that makes sense. But I also wonder like how much they're partnering to make this happen, because, you know, there's a history of Apple partnering, which I think is a good thing, right? If you don't have it in-house at the moment, you don't want to like just not do it, not keep up, right? And so they partnered with Google before to make Chrome the default browser rather than Safari. They've partnered with... And they think they have a big partnership right now with Gemini, right, to bring it potentially in to catch them up a bit, since they delayed their Apple Intelligence release for the next iPhone. And so, you know, I want to say yes. I am hopeful, because I think more players in the game is a good thing. I don't think we should have incumbents that capture like 75% market share when it comes to things like devices, which maybe is what Apple has kind of done in the past. Maybe this is allowing them to share that a little bit more. And this is probably not a favorable, if an Apple exec is listening, is probably like, I don't agree. But I think if in terms of a fair market, that is reality, is that we should have competition. And maybe this is allowing some competition to shine through. So I'm not sure it's the worst thing.
Look, I'm just kind of going to make a reference back to a book again, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams, 1979. And I think he predicted a lot of this with the Babel fish, which was a fish you put in your ear from the Hitchhiker's Guide, and it would translate between languages in real time. I think he's credited with even creating the concept of a tablet, because the Hitchhiker's Guide was, you know, the size of a small pocketbook. It had all the world's information. You could put the babelfish in your ear to give you real-time translation. So I think these are things that humans have wanted for a very, very long time. It came up in fiction. It came up in movies. We've seen various implementations over the years. I remember this feature was present in Skype, which is no longer a thing right now. But in Skype, you could do real-time translation with your, I would say, you know, if you have a family and they speak a different language, you can do real-time translation. I think it's down to the user experience. Making it part of something like your headphones is going to be a lot more conducive to folks who are not used to technology. They're not going to go and download the model. They're not going to go into Skype. I think the first couple of iterations are going to have some interesting teething challenges. So I expect a lot of funny situations in a lot of countries where you think, I can now speak Italian. It's like, no, not quite.
And you cannot.
So I expect there's going to be a couple of challenges, especially if you're going to the local model first. But I see it as a good thing. So I see it as AI becoming integrated into technology to the point where, from a consumer's perspective, it disappears. You don't care what model is being used. You don't care. What's a token? I don't care what a token is, right? I just want this thing to translate what you're saying in real time.
Yeah. I think your point about UX is spot on, Nihai. And I think to your earlier question, Tim, about what feels different, I think that's what Apple is getting right with this. And to the question also about whether or not Apple has a comeback in store, I think that is their avenue, is UX that, as you aptly put it, Mihai, has no reference to the fact that there are tokens anywhere. It just fits into something that's already part of your ecosystem, and it makes it better and it solves a problem. One other incumbency that Apple has is sort of style and popularity. You know, frankly, Tim, seeing you in those nice white headphones, I see people walking down the street with those headphones in all the time, especially all the teens in my neighborhood. It's a look. And so now that those solve an additional problem, that is not saying I have to now put on a clunky pair of additional glasses or some heads-up display that makes me look like a geek to actually bring this technology into my life. It's fitting into something that's already an accepted thing in everyday life. And so the user experience is really spot on. So I think that's the avenue that has some real traction here.
Yeah, just look up on the internet, United Nations translation device. Because you see them at the United Nations and there's like this awkward, cheap looking thing with the antennas. And I think there's a person behind it, but still, it's not a look.
Yeah, for sure. Sandy, final thought on this.
Yeah, I'll wrap this up with a quick story. Earlier this year, I was in Japan doing an awesome solo trip, getting lost in so many train stations and having to ask for directions, right? And so I pull out and I was using GPT because it just is semantically better translation and voice mode in a way, right? And so I was doing the translation, but then I would hand it back to like the older gentleman, and he had no concept how to participate, right? And so it wasn't, he would speak but not press the button, and then I'd press the button too late, and it didn't work, right? Because of the learning gap and the skills gap. And so this, I think, is if they can nail a way to solve this, right, that would bridge that gap where you don't have to change your learning pattern, you just change the experience.
Yeah, this is going to be a super interesting interface, and I want to kind of keep coming back to it as we go about like where the AI will be in this wearable ecosystem. I think it's really interesting. And I think, yeah, as Sandy, you're pointing out, in some ways, like even sort of quote-unquote seamless interfaces have a lot sort of built into them. So a lot to talk about there. I'm going to end this on a final story, which is breaking as of this week. It's a headline that could only come from 2025. And that headline is that NVIDIA is investing $100 billion. I'm laughing as I say it because it's such an absurd number in some ways. $100 billion in OpenAI. And so I want to take the maybe like last 5 minutes of this episode to just talk a little bit about this news. Obviously, the top line number is mind-boggling. But I guess, Mihai, maybe I'll get you to respond to one thing that occurred to me, which is, OpenAI is about to get all this money from NVIDIA. Isn't OpenAI just turning around and giving it back to NVIDIA?
It's like stock buybacks. It's perfect.
I mean, it's kind of strange, right? Like that. Yeah. Actually, we should read this as OpenAI gives NVIDIA $100 billion back, right? I mean, some of it will be spent on personnel and that kind of thing, I'm sure. But yeah. What do we make of that? That seems weird.
It does. But then you look at things like stock buybacks and everybody's doing it. And then you're making billions of dollars. If you look at the Oracle stock, which kind of blew up as well from a very similar event, you're going to see it has a big financial impact. And second, they're sponsoring their biggest client. You know, if OpenAI goes down, they're going to be in trouble. I think there was an article going around that NVIDIA has like, you know, 3-4 large clients and then the rest. And then there's a couple of gamers in there with GPUs, but those are not as important as those 3-4, you know, whale of customers. And there's also the opportunity for AMD or Intel or some other company to come in and say, we have found a solution and OpenAI is going to diversify. So by making the investment, they're locking in their biggest potential target. There is no indication that the OpenAI is going to reduce the number of GPUs they need. They're still making their models, you know, ChatGPT freely available for 1 billion users or whatever the numbers are up to right now. And they're going to continue doing it on NVIDIA GPUs. So I think it's a brilliant move. I think it's going to have massive effects on the industry. I would have wished to see a bit more, I would say, diversity in terms of what's supported for inference providers. So AMD and Intel give us more GPUs, make them better. I've got an AMD GPU right there. I love it. But when it comes to the software, that's where I think CUDA and what NVIDIA is doing still has the lead.
Yeah. Sandy, is Anthropic in trouble? They're sort of left out of this, right? Like,
there seems to be unlimited money right now. I'm not sure. They plan to raise, I think, a $8 billion round just recently and raised a $13 billion round.
They'll be okay, is what you're saying.
Maybe they are in trouble. Maybe this will be a catalyst for them to in order to compete and stay in the ring, to need to raise even more than anticipated. But I feel like we're just going to see more partnerships emerging. We're going to see more alliances, like clubs. You know, something I did want to comment on, though, is the amount of energy that the facilities that they're investing in are putting out is enormous, right? Like, I think typically Meta has notoriously some of the biggest scale projects in this industry, and this, like, outcompetes that tenfold. I think the number was that they expect 10 gigawatts of power, at least, from the facility, which is like 1 billion light bulbs at a time.
It's a lot of light bulbs.
It's kind of insane.
Yeah. Well, Gabe, maybe you can take us home for the final comment. I mean, this kind of idea of tribes, I think, is really interesting, because it does sort of feel like we're getting, like, it's going to be Gryffindor and Ravenclaw. It's going to be, you know, Harkonnen and what have you. Like, I it feels like initially it was, oh, okay, well, Anthropic's going to kind of pair off with, say, Amazon, and OpenAI is going to pair off with Microsoft. And that's for the sort of cloud, right? And then now it feels like, okay, well, the next step in the game is OpenAI is going to go with NVIDIA. And I don't know, maybe Anthropic is going to go with AMD, right? And then, like, I guess the next step in that game would be, Sandy, what you're talking about is, I guess, like, OpenAI is going to go with, like, Northeastern Nuclear Power, you know, company, and Anthropic's going to go with, you know, Southwestern, you know, wind power or something like that. I guess, Gabe, like, where does this all go in terms of market structure? Like, do we feel like we're going to almost have these, like, vertically integrated alliances start to emerge over time? Because, I mean, traditionally, we've seen, like, NVIDIA selling its chips to everybody. And I think this does really seem to put the thumb on the scale a little bit, right?
I think this is a big bet, frankly, that bigger is still better, right? I think we've hit a point now with some really, really good frontier models trained on the infrastructure that already exists. And we're seeing that huge gains in capability are being achieved, not necessarily just by training the newest models, but by training, by building the systems around the models. And 2025, the year of the agents. And, you know, we've covered everything under the sun about, and I keep coming back to, you know, models are just generating tokens. It's what you put around them that actually adds the value. And I think, you know, there's a real obvious loser in moving the innovation from the models to the systems, and that's NVIDIA, right? Because you don't need to buy more chips if you've already got enough, right? You don't need to boost your data center size if your models, if you can keep refining the models with the same hardware you already have. And so I think this is a huge bet on NVIDIA's part to say, hey, we believe that bigger is still better, and we're going to make bigger happen and see what happens. So they're putting their money where their mouth is, very self-interestedly, as you put, Tim, and it's going to come back to them in the chips anyway. But I think, where does this shake the industry out? It's going to come down to the technology of whether big is in fact better. And Sandy, to your point, eventually this power consumption, the environmental impact, can we source this power responsibly? Like, we're kind of hit some breaking points there when you're talking about orders of magnitude this big. And I'd be curious to see, I mean, again, it's really uncharted territory. It's a push to explicitly try to push into further uncharted territory so that this critical resource, the next generation of GPUs, is still a commodity that is desperately, desperately needed. We'll see where those uncharted territories lead.
Gabe, to your point, before we wrap up, I'm curious whether the $100 billion will completely go to facility, or they're maybe making that next investment in the next type of chip or the next architecture. Like, is this a play for whatever's next?
Very possible, but I think, you know, the top line power numbers and the top line scale numbers still really hint at bigger is better. I think, you know, theoretically, you could invest $100 billion in chips that are 10x more efficient rather than 10x more powerful. But I don't think that's what they're doing here. And so it seems like this is clearly just trying to push the upper envelope of, you know, raw compute. But I'm sure some of that will go into the ecosystem. And I don't know, I didn't get into the details of the article about how much is up to the discretion of OpenAI versus how much of this is just build the biggest data center that's ever been built and staff it up with our GPUs.
Can you smell the AGI?
Yes, I suppose we all can. That's a great note to end on. That's all the time that we have for today. So Mihai, Sandy, Gabe, thank you for joining us as always. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.